Welcome to the RevRec Gals podcast, where two consultants with over 30 years combined experience share stories about the implementation and challenges of revenue recognition accounting. I'm Susan.
And I'm Natasha.
And we are the RevRec Gals. Welcome to another episode of the RevRec Gals. The topic today is going to be on collectibility and whether a contract exists. If you determine it doesn't exist, how do you account for it? Natasha, give us a little background on collectibility and things we should think about.
When I think about collectibility, I think a lot of people think collectibility and think bad debt expense. And they think, you know, how do we write off bad debts? Interestingly, under 606, you really have to think about collectibility right up front. Because if you don't have reasonable collectibility, that's one of the criteria for a revenue contract to exist. So if you're sending contracts and you really don't have a reasonable shot at collecting, it isn't actually a contract according to the accounting guidance. So it's one of the very first things you have to assess before you continue on into the five-step model and even consider anything else. I think it's important for people not to skip that step, because if you do, you end up overstating revenue and expense rather than reducing your revenue.
It's interesting because I see different companies. Some are more sophisticated in their method of assessing collectibility. They may have signed up with an outside firm, in which case all their customers go through this filter to tell them what's the likelihood they're going to collect, or are there any red flags such as bankruptcy or other issues. Other ones, especially smaller companies, aren't as sophisticated and will have to do some other kind of analysis. One of the high levels I've seen is looking at the economics of a country. So sometimes Latin American countries will have extremely high rates of inflation. And I've seen where any company from a certain country will be deemed to have questionable collectibility. What other have you seen?
I've absolutely seen that. But another more recent one is at some point there were Russian sanctions that were put on certain banking institutions, and overnight there were companies that weren't able to pay. Frankly, it wasn't legal to do that overnight. And so all of a sudden, some of my clients were going through their revenue contracts and saying, does a contract exist? Have the circumstances changed? Because not only do you have to do this assessment upfront when you sign the contract, but if there's any circumstances that are material that have changed that would trigger reassessment, you have to reassess that contract from that day forward. So people were having to go back and reassess, is this contract collectible today? It met the criteria in the past. At the outset of the contract, it counted. So we're not going to go back and change the past. It is what it is. If I can't collect on it, it's bad debt expense. But from this day forward, I know better and I need to reduce my revenue accordingly. And so that was another one where macroeconomic things that are going on that have large consequences, you don't think about those things impacting the way you do accounting necessarily. But the truth is everyone's scrambling. And to your point about small businesses versus larger businesses, larger companies may have better data and controls around which contracts are out of which entity, which contracts are recorded to what country, where the small company that's just starting out doesn't have very good processes, doesn't have very good reporting, are going through and opening their contracts to a certain extent, or trying to just talk to people to say, hey, do we have any contracts out of Russia?
Yeah, I do see a number of companies where, to your point, instead of doing a bad debt reserve, they're doing a sales reserve to offset that revenue.
Exactly. And so that's where when the contract doesn't meet the criteria for collectibility to begin with, it's not a contract. And so it's a sales return. You reduce the revenue rather than recognizing bad debt expense, where you have the revenue and the expense.
So that's assessing when you're down the line. But when you are on day one assessing collectibility, or there may be other factors, like I've seen where sales reps come out and said, oh, well, how about we sign the contract and we just make a note that we're going to finalize these other three points. Well, if you have these three points that are out there to be negotiated, do you really have a contract in substance, or do you have something that could impact that revenue? So you may then have a booking in the beginning. So not only do you have to remove the revenue or the deferred revenue, wherever it's sitting, but you also have to reverse that booking if you know at the time that the booking occurs.
Yeah, no, if it doesn't meet the criteria of the contract, whether it's that it truly has been approved, whether you've defined the enforceable rights for both parties, do you really have a contract? And it's interesting because under the old guidance, under 605, if you had a contract that was still in the process of being negotiated, you didn't have a contract. And so I had circumstances where there was no revenue and it felt really inappropriate, to be honest, that there was nothing. The beauty is you have flexibility under 606 so that if it in substance, you truly do have a contract and maybe it's not done being negotiated, but you have enough to really meet the substance that a contract exists, you can record revenue. That's great. What's hard is now it's subjective. Now it's a little bit gray. Now you have to go through and do that assessment. Have I met these criteria or not? I know there's other things being negotiated, and it's possible that that means that really it's not completely approved. Really, we haven't defined everything. Maybe they've given us some money, some sort of deposit to get started, but we don't really have a defined revenue contract.
I've seen two different instances like that, where you may have a memo of understanding where they'll give you a deposit, which doesn't have the details that you need for the contract. It may not have payment terms, may not have some of the other criteria. On the flip side, I've seen contracts where a majority of it is there, but they'll be negotiating the timing or maybe something that's really not revenue related.
Or additional add-ons or products to add to it.
Yeah. And then you can assess and potentially say, yes, I have a contract. These other negotiations don't impact my revenue because I'm not going to recognize until we deliver anyway. And it's a question of when do we deliver or something else that is not revenue impacting.
Ancillary to the revenue contract terms. Something we keep alluding to, but we haven't explicitly said, is this idea of a customer deposit. Typically, when we take money in, it's recorded to deferred revenue. We receive the money or we invoice, it goes to AR, it goes to deferred revenue. We collect the money, we remove it from AR and recognize the cash. But if we receive cash prior to actually having a contract, it becomes a customer deposit. And so it's a reclassification on your balance sheet. And it is important. If it's sizable, that's a significant reclassification that you'd have to make that could show up on the face of your financial statements. When I think about that collectability assessment, one of the things that I think about from a practical perspective, and I know we've both seen this, is the idea of implementing a process with purchase orders. And often I see that being a requirement of the sales organization to help facilitate collection. Because if we're going to book it and it's going to go towards commission, we want to be able to collect on it. We don't want to be paying commissions on something that we can't collect on. And maybe someone somewhere signed a contract, but did they get a purchase order? Were they authorized? Is there a budget associated with it? Is that something you've seen as well?
I have. So the question that my clients have said is, will the company pay without a purchase order? A lot of companies require a purchase order. In a different instance, resellers, where you have a contract, it looks great, but you kind of have it open-ended where they have a percentage discount or maybe they have targets. But until you start to get those POs that have that incremental information on them, you don't have that contract.
Just to make sure I'm understanding, you're saying you have a framework set up with your reseller that they're authorized to resell your product, but until you have a PO, no one's actually made a purchase that has, we're selling X license for this many seats for this price.
Right. Because oftentimes the reseller contract is very broad and it may have, you get 20% off this category of products and 10% off these services. But you don't have that last piece of what did they actually order and what are you going to ship? And what are they going to pay? Because you have to have a transaction value. And that transaction value comes through on as part of that PO.
That's a great point because in those reseller transactions, it's a win to get a reseller transaction. Don't get me wrong. I don't want to discount that. But you don't actually have a revenue contract until that PO shows up. So I have seen in certain circumstances where instead of a PO, companies can do some sort of PO waiver where the sales rep will go to their contacts and get some sort of signed waiver confirming that a PO is not required in order to collect on an invoice.
I've seen that too.
Yeah, I think it's a good tool. And I think even if it's, I see it as two things. One, it's confirming that collectability. If it's required, it's required. But not having that in some cases, depending on the company, may not necessarily preclude revenue. I do think certain companies set up a policy around it on what defines a contract from their perspective. Theoretically, not having a PO doesn't preclude recognizing revenue if you have a contract with all the terms laid out and all the criteria met and you theoretically could collect. It's sometimes it's more of a paperwork thing. You don't want to end up getting it to collections. Now it's 30 days overdue. You follow up and they're like, hey, you need the PO. And then you're tracking down the PO and your poor AR people, your AR team is trying to meet their collections quota. And they're having to track down a sales rep who's already moved on because that was last quarter's deal. It becomes almost an efficiency thing. While you have the attention of the sales rep, while you have the attention of the person purchasing, get that information in. It becomes way more efficient to do it up front.
Well, it does help if on the invoice you're referencing that contract. That seems to help get around the fact that no PO has been provided.
If we talk about purchase orders up front and assessing collectability up front, there's always a wide range here. I'm sure we've both seen one end of the spectrum and the other. So some large companies will have a full-on assessment with Dun & Bradstreet, and their AR team will have a very specific definition of how they go through that process. Is it a public company? If it's not a public company, we pull a report, we do other assessments. Maybe there's a dollar threshold in place for how robust they get. But then there's the companies that don't do much. And then you have something, everything in between.
But then there's also the companies that have super high volumes. And how do you manage such a high volume, especially if you're providing a service to an everyday person like Netflix or Zoom or any of those SaaS companies? It's tough to figure out, is this customer collectible? And I think in some cases, they have to set up a policy after they've already started selling the service to determine what they're going to do about it.
That's a great point. And I think for some of those, especially if it's consumer facing or really small businesses, high volume self-service model, it's usually paid by credit card. And so it automatically charges. However, I always see those reports of the credit card didn't go through. For a consumer, if our credit card expired or didn't go through on Netflix, we turn on our TV, it doesn't let us in. And we say, oh crap, I have to go get my credit card. I want to, you know, we just go do it kind of right away or we don't. And, you know, they turn off the subscription. And so revenue is paused anyway. But then you have maybe the bigger serving customers who still have self-service model. They don't want to cut their customers off right away, even if they are paying by credit card. And so you'll have these open ones where you're given a grace period, they get alerts, you will lose access in X number of days. And so maybe you rely on company history to see how often or how likely is it for them to actually just stop paying and go away. Beauty of SaaS is the consequences are real in that you get cut off. I've actually seen for smaller companies in the SaaS space, there's less pressure there because the truth is as you're recognizing revenue, you're collecting pretty much in parallel. And if you find out that you can't collect, you just stop revenue. And so there's usually not a very material gap there. And so I do see those earlier stage companies sort of get away with doing less because of that tool that's at their disposal to just shut off revenue shut off the subscription.
Well, not only do they have to shut off the subscription, but they've got to reverse whatever revenue they have recognized because they haven't been paid. However, a majority of the time, that's occurring within the same quarter. Because if you have a short 30 or even 60-day window or, you know, 45, whatever the case may be, you're more often than not going to be within your quarter. So even though you're having to fully reverse revenue that you recognized, it's not going to impact your financials in a negative way.
That's true. It happens within a period or, you know, the few scenarios that crossover periods usually aren't very large. And so, if you have a couple exceptions, it's fine. And ultimately, I think there's a decision tree there too of, is this a reversal revenue or is this bad debt expense and how you go through that?
And also you can have a process where you're estimating. So even if it does go over a quarter or a month end, you can estimate either based on how many open POs you have or based on your historical rates.
Yeah. And to your point about those historical rates, the larger volume you have, the more data you have to support that. If you have a lower volume, that becomes a more difficult conversation. That's where you do a little bit more work. But the higher volume you have that history, you have that data that says, hey, we have this data. This is what typically happens. It's pretty consistent. Nothing has shifted. No, there's nothing about our business or the economic climate that's changed significantly. So we're going to rely on that estimate. The other point to make here too is we talked about some geographic challenges, but even just economic, you know, if the economic climate has changed. I remember dealing with a client in the middle of COVID and they were in the middle of a CECL implementation and trying to figure out their new process for AR and reserves, and COVID hit. And so they said to themselves, are our travel and lodging customers going to pay? Because no one's traveling right now. No one's taking flights. And, you know, the big airlines, while I do think that many of them probably negotiated or changed their contracts during this period of time because, for obvious reasons, not very many of them went under or out of business. But when it came to smaller hotel chains or other sort of travel-related industries, a lot of places did go out of business or just completely shut down and had no way of paying. Even if they did figure out a way to survive, they had to shut down overnight and just had to say, no, I can't pay this. Hopefully we don't have another big shutdown like that for more reasons than accounting. But it is anything, any big event like that, that impacts an entire industry or sector. You really have to think about that, whether it's a, you know, financial industry, travel industry, whatever it is.
I think that, especially given your example of COVID, it was very pervasive, except for the companies that really benefited from it, like the security companies and the
grocery stores.
Yeah, things like that. Almost everyone I know had customers renegotiating contracts, at least in the short term. And so you are now stuck with, how do I deal with this? And the unknown of how long is this going to last?
And is this a return? Is this a refund? Is this a modification? Is this bad debt? Trying to navigate all that, and not just on the one-off basis, but in a pervasive way, can be really challenging. And I think maybe to that end, it's a conversation about how do you look at your population of contracts? You know, if you're a low volume business model where you have maybe larger contracts, lower volume, you can afford to do the Dun & Bradstreet. You can afford to do the one-by-one analysis. You can prioritize by dollar amount and other risk factors, whether it's geography or industry, et cetera. But if you do have a high volume, or maybe you have different divisions where you have this part of your business where it's low volume and you can do it that way, and then you have a different part of your business where it's high volume, self-service, and you have to take a completely different approach to looking at that population and stratifying it. Have you seen from a collections perspective, when people are coming up with their reserves, some sort of stratification that was helpful?
I have. I've been with SaaS companies that are high volume, and what they'll do is look at their different customer types. So they'll have one for maybe the online and the everyday consumer like you or me. Then they may have one for more of the small businesses, medium dollars, and then one for resellers and maybe another one for higher volume. The lower volume, everyday you and me, probably is a little more volatile, because you have credit cards that maybe are expired, or surprisingly, a lot of fraud at that level, or just people who forget to pay, or they didn't realize somebody in their household signed up, and so they put a claim into their credit cards or whatnot. There's a lot of variability there. But then you start to get a little more stable as you get into the higher ranges. So they may have different percentages for each of those. Also, I've seen where they categorize based on how long the debt has been outstanding, which makes a lot of sense. You know, if you're over 90 days, you know, what's your likelihood of collection? If you're 30 or 60, you never know. They could have just forgotten that their credit card expired and they haven't gone back in, or something slipped through the cracks. So there's the different ways to cut and slice and estimate. on what your debt is going to be. And then if a company you know goes out of business, pick up all of their receivables and decide what to do with it.
I think that's a great point, because when you're looking at this, often you're doing this in collaboration with your AR team, in collaboration with your account management, customer success teams, to stay in conversation around these, especially the larger ones, of how are we going to treat this? And so usually there's some sort of month-end review that happens with an AR person, a revenue person, talk through them. Usually the AR people are in pretty good contact with the account managers as well and can provide that context, but every once in a while you might need to talk to them directly. But I find that exercise really helpful just to talk through some of those big ones, because it is a gray area, and determining at what point have we crossed over into this isn't collectible, we need to reserve for it, whether it's expense and then reserve the revenue going forward if there's still revenue scheduled in the system, and at what point it's time to write it off. It really is an exercise of collaboration with those other teams.
Yeah, I do find that it gets super complicated if you write it off and then later the person comes back and actually repays the debt and says, I do want my service. I'm going to back pay and start over.
Yes, that usually doesn't happen too often once you get to the point where you're ready to write it off. I've only seen it a few times. You do find it only takes once or twice for it to happen where people are like, I'm just going to keep it on my books for a little bit longer. I'm going to reserve and just keep it for another 30 to 60 days, because it's a pain to have to rebook it once you've already written it off.
Yeah, I have seen that where they'll identify it and they'll put the reserve in, but they won't actually write off for another 30 or 60 days just in case the payment does come in.
And I think that's where quarter end becomes. You do your month end review, but then you do the quarter end so that you feel really good by the time you get to the quarter end, like what's really happened here.
This concludes our episode. Stay tuned bi-weekly as we talk all things revenue recognition. You can be notified of new episodes and other information by following us on LinkedIn. Feedback and topic suggestions are always welcome through LinkedIn or by emailing us at revrecgals@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. The examples discussed are based on specific company dynamics. Check in with your auditors before making changes to your current processes. Specializing in revenue recognition may result in employment for life. Please consult your friends and family before pursuing this career.